Hey everyone, this is Kumari Bandare from Black and Brown in Bioethics, and you're listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, the show that gets together with academics from marginalized backgrounds to question academic hierarchies, structures, and conventions, unpack their inherent issues, and discuss solutions. Today, we're talking about activism and advocacy in bioethics as a postgraduate with Professor Patricia Kingori, Dr. Agamuni Ganguly Mitra, and Dr. Aisha Ahmed. We'll discuss what there is to know about the reality of engaging in activism and advocacy as a postgraduate. What barriers, challenges, benefits, risks, and obligations exist, and how can postgraduates find support? Today's episode is a bit different than the others in that it is a recording of a panel discussion that we hosted at the Postgraduate Bioethics Conference in 2023 in Edinburgh. We are thankful to the organizers of the conference, Emma Nance and Jamie Webb, for giving us a platform to host a panel discussion on the topic of activism and advocacy. And now to introduce the speakers. Professor Patricia Kingori is a professor of global health ethics and Wellcome Trust senior investigator at University of Oxford. Her research interests intersect the sociology of science and medicine, and she has extensive experience of undertaking critical examinations of ethics in practice in different countries in Africa and Southeast Asia. Patricia is committed to equality, diversity, and inclusion issues in academia. Our second speaker, Dr. Agamuni Ganguly Mitra, is lecturer and Chancellor's Fellow in Bioethics and Global Health Ethics and Deputy Director of the J.K. Mason Institute for Medicine. She has a special interest in global bioethics, structural, and gender justice. She has written on ethical issues related to global health emergencies, public health, global surrogacy, sex selection, biomedical research, racism in health, and the concepts of exploitation, vulnerability, and power in bioethics. And our third speaker, Dr. Aisha Ahmed, is a lecturer in global health specializing in mental health and gender-based violence during conflict. She provides expert reports in culture and mental health for the use in asylum cases and publishes in both academic and journalistic forums. Aisha develops trauma therapeutic interventions using traditional storytelling and has an ongoing research project in Kashmir in India and Turkey in collaboration with Afghanistan, Tunisia, and South Africa.
To get the conversation started, how would you define activism and advocacy? Agamuni, would you like to go first?
Thank you all for being here today. I guess we could call activism and advocacy anything you do to steer a certain political or social cause in a certain direction. But for me, it's always related to, more often than not, a social justice cause. So for me, anything that I think I do that's related to advocacy and activism is more or less going to be related to working towards social justice, towards equality.
I love that. Patricia, do you have any response or any addition to make?
Well, firstly, thank you very much for inviting me. It's really great to be part of this panel, such esteemed colleagues. I think that it can take different forms, and I think sometimes, you know, it's operating at different paces. So for me, I think advocacy and activism is often sort of quite quiet and it's done in the shadows, but it's essentially trying to rearrange and include different voices in spaces where traditionally they might not be found. So I think a kind of a subversive energy, I think often, but I think it operates in different spaces depending on the amount of power and leverage people have. But I think for me, it's often about just trying to rearrange structures.
And Aisha, would you like to comment as well?
Thank you. In addition to the wonderful points already raised, this is a question I had to be confronted to face actually more frequently as I progressed in academia for different reasons in terms of how my identity has been explained by others without realizing the kind of boxes I would be put in. So I think in terms of activism, for me, it speaks to a particular story, some kind of authentic story that you hold that keeps your commitment to doing what you're doing, even when there's so much turmoil and struggles to do that. I don't necessarily think you have to have lived experience of that particular story in terms of direct exposure to what it is that you are committed to, but that there has to have been some unveiling of that story in some capacity that has helped you bear some meaning towards it. For advocacy, I think for me, I have to come across the inverse of it. So when I provide in my academic expert witness reports, I have to actually sign declarations that I'm not going to be an advocate for that individual, even though I'm providing a report to support that person's asylum process. I find in my work, the advocacy comes more behind the scenes. So I'm advocating often for early career researchers who are based in other countries who are doing the brave, they're in the brunt of all of the work that, in particularly in my area, we are doing, but often don't get any of the equity or justice that they should do, not just societally, but also in the academic environment as well.
Thanks for that overview and also for making it a bit personal, because I did want to get quite personal in the next question and ask everyone how it is that engaging in activism and advocacy has shaped your academic careers, your goals and motivations. Why don't we start with Patricia this time?
Oh, gosh, that was a bit longer, shorter time to think about that. But so the question is, how has activism and advocacy shaped my career? Yes.
Yes.
I think it's only been possible really at certain stages. And I think that part of the frustration felt by most early career researchers is actually how little space they often can have to feel that they're making meaningful change. And by that, I mean that, you know, if you're in an institution as a student or as an early career researcher in insecure contracts, you have the time, you're there to try to do something. And sometimes that's 2 to 3 years max, and then you're not quite sure what's going to happen after you've left, how much of that's going to be sustained. So I think one of the things I've really valued about being in the same place for almost a decade is actually just being able to slowly and take time and care to try to change things around me in a much more sustained way. I've been surprised by just how long things have taken to change and how much work requires actually to maintain any initiatives and things that I've tried to work on. So in terms of how it's shaped my career, I would definitely say I've been the recipient of other people's advocacy work. I would absolutely see that I'm sort of standing on the shoulders of giants and really appreciate the work that's been done by previous generations and Black and Brown academics to make this space a place where I feel much more comfortable than they did in previous decades. And I think for me, it just felt like a kind of a responsibility that I've had and what I wanted to do in appreciation and recognition of that. So in all of my work, I think it's important in terms of the care I give to participants, the care I give to early career researchers, and also just constantly trying to maintain spaces that everybody feels comfortable.
Thank you for that, Patricia. That was very helpful. And yes, the recognition that in the past, so many people have done so much work and we are benefiting from that, and that we do have a responsibility to move forward as well. Aisha, would you like to say something as well?
Thank you. I would say that at least in the beginning, I did not know the work that I was doing would be recognized as a form of activism. And I certainly did not, and perhaps still do not, recognize or want to credit myself with being how I perceive an activist to be in the world. But that said, there's a thread that led me to where I am in terms of the question about how do women survive war and trauma, and that has a personal narrative to it. And it was only because, similar to Patricia, I've had great support, great mentors along the way, that there have been stepping stones that have shown me actually this question can become an area of your research. You can develop methodologies, you can develop theoretical frameworks, conceptual analysis, you can actually develop the connections that you've got to become research projects. So in that way, it's been much more concrete. And now I'm much more conscious of the position that I have and the decisions that I can make that can be much more overtly activist, and because of the moral obligations I feel, especially in the current climate of my work, having existing research projects at the time of the Taliban takeover nearly 2 years ago, those led to very different moral obligations. And even now, if I'm applying for a research grant, thinking about, well, what is the meaning of the work that I'm going to be applying to do? I have to, for me, the activist element is part of that justification for choosing where to put resources, choosing what research to build, rather than it just being something not just of course, no research is just pure curiosity, but it needs to be producing something that is going to be more than just contributing to academic knowledge. And I think now I'm much more conscious of those decisions around activism in academia.
Absolutely. I think it is very important to acknowledge and respond to the realities that we are surrounded by hegemony.
I'd echo everything my colleague said here. I think I wasn't, at least in the context of academia, I don't think I was an activist to start with. I think activism and the sense that I might fight for something came from personal experiences rather than academic experiences. So this idea that, you know, the moment I'm in an airport and I'm going to try to sort of cross a border with a Swiss passport, they look at me and they go, we don't understand what's going on here. And they'll assume that I'm trying to cross borders illegally or whatever it is, you know, those kind of microaggressions that happen to you all the time. And then I started recognizing them in academia as well, right? So if I'm not carrying this badge around, it does happen that somebody will come and ask me for a drink, you know, for me to serve them a drink and things like that. And just like colleague said, when I was earlier on, when I was an early career researcher, I did not have the power of the privilege. I did not have the position where I could do anything about it in terms of my academic citizenship, in terms of choosing what kind of topics I want to work on and who I want to fight for. But these things change with experience and with security as well. And the more secure you are in your academic position, the more you feel like you're able to, but also that you've got the responsibility to then create those spaces, and as Piotr was saying, for those who don't have that kind of platform.
I'm glad you mentioned job security in academia, because this is going to be a great segue for the next extremely controversial and contentious point/question I want to bring up. There's a lot of existing debate as to whether junior researchers who don't have much security should engage in activism and advocacy. And for instance, Greg Morlock actually claims that it would be harmful or detrimental to researchers' credibility and create more negative consequences to their careers. And he argues for something called effective activism, which entails becoming established as an academic before setting out to do activism. So I wanted to ask what you think about his point of view. What information, you know, should a junior academic factor in when deciding whether or not to engage in activism? And if so, how to engage in activism that won't be detrimental to their careers? And also, how can a junior academic anticipate some of these consequences and prepare for them to find ways to work around them?
I probably would say that sometimes trying to create security in academia is a form of activism in itself. That said, I was also very naive when I was starting out before I had a permanent contract and that for security. I thought that doing good work, which for me was synonymous with some form of activist work, would actually, there wouldn't be a jar in between what would create risk or harm at that stage of the career. So I probably was very naive, because as I progress and I can really see how actually sometimes I feel it's much harder for me at this stage to speak about things that I previously would have done so without any issue, because before I was seen to be, this is where you belong, you're at the beginning, you just have these short-term contracts. But now when you're in a more secure position and you say certain things, or you want to create certain forms of change, particularly in research culture, then you're seen as speaking out of tone. So those complexities that I didn't expect to come across. I think it depends on the goals at different stages, what you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it. Perhaps more subtle, but I think it's very difficult to separate. If you're committed to your work, it's very difficult to say, this is not going to be activism for this number of years until I got this position. I find it depends on your nature of work, but I find it very hard to be able to disentangle both.
So I guess I'm terrible at sort of shutting my mouth. So I've often gone into trouble for saying, you know, things that were not palpable, you know, sort of acceptable to others. But also I've very early on got this feeling that you cannot be apolitical if you look the way I look in predominantly white and predominantly male dominated context as well. So I thought, hey, you know, what are you going to do about it? I might as well. But at the same time, I think it's worth thinking about strategies as well. So just to be aware that there are some topics that are going to be more acceptable than others. In, for example, if you're working in an institution, gender, for example, is much more mainstream than is race. So do you want to be part maybe of an EDI committee to start with before you start decolonizing the curriculum? You know, those kinds of strategic things are worth thinking about. Lots of things you could be working on, the topics you choose to teach. If you have guest lecturing, for example, the kind of reading lists you give to your students. So those are small ways of being activists without necessarily sort of becoming hyper visible, which is all too easy for people like us to become in institutions.
More helpful wisdom there. And Patricia?
I think it's a really great question. I think it's really complicated because I think on the one hand, I think institutions benefit greatly from the work that junior researchers do in actually pushing forward the agenda of some of these issues that often people can see, but they mightn't have the time or they have other things that they have to do. And I suppose my concern about junior researchers carrying this heavy load is the weight of the load and the time it takes and, you know, the fact that often this is thankless. It can take you away from the work that you're actually employed to do. And it feels like an additional tax on top of everything else. And, you know, I'm speaking really personally about this, but also in relation to colleagues that I know that just being involved in so many panel discussions after Black Lives Matter was the emotional labour of that was just so intense, so draining and so difficult to manage. It was really difficult because on the one hand, it's an opportunity to talk. But on the other hand, what happens after you've opened up this Pandora's box of all these really difficult feelings and you've called things out, you've spoken truth to power, you've done all those things, then where is a space for care, either self-care or institutional care? So I always feel that for junior researchers, it's really important to firstly observe before anything is done. And really get a good sense of what the lay of the land is, like what somebody's able to do in one department and say in one department, even in the same institution, is very, very different to what can happen in another department with a different line manager. And I've known people who have had literally like their careers have been, I would say, slowed down, if not completely stopped, because they've been, you know, seen as a troublemaker or saying the thing that most people can see, but they felt that they, you know, had to say, but it's meant really difficult repercussions because they haven't shored up allies or they haven't understood how that institution works. So sometimes I feel like it's a bit of a trap for early junior researchers where people are invited to please speak your mind and tell us what's really going on. And then all of a sudden you find actually that the people that aren't saying very much or saying things in a different way are finding that their careers and opportunities to be collaborating on papers and projects are there and not for the people who are actually saying the thing that everybody can see. So I think it's really difficult. It's not really for me to tell somebody not to do something if they see something's going on. But my experience has been that it's really important to get allies. I've learned the hard way that just kind of jumping in both feet first and not making a proper evaluation and assessment of either the amount of work that's needed, the infrastructure of the place and what will happen afterwards can have really difficult repercussions. So I'm not quite sure if that's answered your question, but I think it's quite a complex question in many ways. I don't think it's really straightforward for me to answer, at least.
I appreciate the transparency and honesty with which you approached that question and just said it as it is, because I think it's important for us to be aware of that. This is the reality and we work within it. We are moving now to looking at activism and advocacy in a critical way. Is there a burden on some academics from disadvantaged backgrounds to engage in activism and advocacy because they cannot ignore the realities that they themselves might be affected by? Or because there's an expectation that they represent the interests of others that look like them, whether or not they want to? And then how might this perpetuate gaps in privilege, given that academia rewards things like publications over advocacy?
So I guess my response to this is echoing a lot of what Patricia just said. So yes, there is a burden, especially if you start saying something, if you start opening your mouth, you become other person to go to ask about X, Y, and Z, because you've said one thing about that thing a few months back. There's a lot of extraction that goes on with this kind of labor. And it's not because necessarily the institution's out to get you all the time, but that's the system that it's built on. So it's built on extraction. So it's going to be, to a certain extent, quite exploitative. And it's going to be absolutely draining, as Patricia said. So you have to be very, very careful how you position yourself in these debates. Now, especially if you're going to be a critical friend to the institution where you're working, be very careful how you do it. See if you've got a community that you can work with whom you can work slowly and make plans and organize, rather than becoming what's often known as, you know, once you become the person who complains, you become the problem of the institution. So it's both your labor is extracted, you're being exploited for the kinds of things you're expected to represent, but at the same time, you're not going to be thanked for it, and you're going to start becoming the problem if you're too loud, unless you have these allies, you have this community to rely upon with whom you can work together.
I mean, I would definitely echo what Agumani has said, and I would say there's an extreme burden, and that burden comes from all different directions. It can come from sometimes genuine, good-intentioned expectations that are placed on you. You get considered to be an expert on multiple things that you might not even have any expertise in at all, just because you might have an Islamic name, for example. When my work is on clinical ethics, I often get sent the Islamic cases and expected to be a theologian, even though I'm not. So on that kind of level, that's one thing just to mention more superficially. But on other levels, it's, as Agumani said, I mean, really the last few years, I've felt that burden and that the exhaustion that comes. So during the research grant, with what's happened in the last 2 years in my research context, instead of being able to sit there and write publications, I was still trying to arrange evacuations, dealing with everyday horrors and realities of living in the violent situations where my friends and colleagues are. And those are all consuming, and they take priority over my writing. So even though I'm doing a lot of work and a lot of labor, they're not things I'm able to submit. And I want to be able to reflect on them, but academic spaces don't often permit the kind of discourses or examples and stories that I want to be able to include because they weren't part of official research. But often these researchers are coming from positions where they're non-activists, so they're not given the research questions in ways that would generate those kind of narratives to be able to produce in articles. So there's the researcher silencing is something that I've really started to focus on as an aspect of what I hope to change, you know, as I continue to work in these areas. And also, my final point is those who are able to share that burden, the community is vital, but often you feel that when you need to discuss it or you need to reflect to somebody about it, they're able to understand because they're already carrying those burdens. And those who do not, who would be in a position emotionally to withstand it, are so divorced and detached from it, and often will just, you know, see you as being emotional, being difficult, not being unprofessional because you got too closely involved. There are all of those conflicts, not just in terms of who you work with, how you form that community, but also how you interact with that community as well.
Yes, and I also just wanted to say that I particularly liked that you mentioned how we can be more critical in how we do research, what questions we ask, and that itself can be a form of activism and advocacy, because I think as postgraduates, that's a good way to think about how it is that we can create an impact or have an impact on the work that we do and the communities that we work with. Patricia, I'm going to say that you used your incredible powers of foresight and already answered this question in answering the previous one. So we're going to now move on to a slightly different question and move more towards a structural level of things, which has been implicit in all the questions asked already. I just wanted to ask, in an academic culture where academic prestige is tied with tasks such as publishing papers, what can institutions do to compensate and recognize the expertise and time contributed by academics towards the meaningful diversification of academia and therefore the betterment of research? How can academic institutions and structures change to welcome and encourage activism and advocacy? Will it be helpful for institutions to consider activism as a form of academic output? And is there an obligation for academic institutions to do so?
There's a lot in that question. I'm going to just try and answer it. I'm going to try and answer really talking about publications, because as a marker of prestige and the problems that there are around publishing. So my first two papers, which weren't highly read or anything, but it was really important, I had to fight to actually publish them by two separate line managers. So two different projects actively and explicitly blocked me from publishing. I was told that I couldn't publish, and I was in the project for so long and I wasn't publishing, and other people were publishing the data that I was collecting, that I just went ahead and published, and I needed to publish in order to get my my funding for a PhD. So I took the view that it was better to ask for pardon than permission, because I had tried and it didn't really get me anywhere. And I think that there is this idea somehow that everybody is working in the best interest of early career researchers. And when you find yourself actively being blocked, it's not an accident that the landscape and the structures look the way they do. You really need to have someone. I mean, I just, at that point, I was just like, you know what? I'm going to see what I can do to publish. I submitted it just before the Christmas holidays. And then I just kind of, it was terrible. I waited, my first paper, I waited until all over the Christmas period, January, when my line manager found out, absolutely furious with me, you know, but I had already got through my probation period at that point. And it was like, are you going to actually fire me for publishing a paper? Because that needs to be explained to somebody in human resources. So at that point, I just gotten so fed up with just not having the opportunity to publish. And I think it's really important to pay attention to that, actually, because there are all these barriers that actually actively stop people from progressing. Another barrier is actually getting funding. So it's really, I'm not telling anything that everybody in the room hasn't experienced, but having grants ideas taken away from them or being actively blocked for a grant idea. And I think, you know, one of the things that, one of the reasons why I think Oxford actually is able to get so many grants, at least in my department, is that there isn't an internal system that reviews the grants and then tells us, the principal investigator, this grant won't go any further. They leave it for the funder to decide. And what I've learned is that that internal system where the grant proposal is reviewed internally has blocked so many people from progressing in their careers, because it isn't really the funder that says you can't get the money. It's actually your institution and sometimes people in your very department that says this grant isn't ready, it's not quite right. And I think those are the kinds of things that really stopped people from moving forward. And I think sometimes it does require looking at the writing on the wall. You know, I mean, I was in a situation where my first project, so few people were getting publications, first authored publications, that I knew that if I were to stay and even get a job to move on, I would have had to publish and just face the consequences of that. So I'm not saying that everybody does this. I'm just saying that's what I did. And it's a really realistic and real life example, if I use my own personal experience, that sometimes access to the ladder isn't as easy as people say. Oh, you need to get these publications, you need to get these grant proposals, you know, you need to be able to go to conferences and give papers. And all of those things have to be actively fought for. They're very rarely given. And I think just understanding that allows you then to have a strategy to work out, how am I going to get this? What do I need to do? Because it's very rarely given. I had very few examples early on in my career where that was given to me.
Thank you, Patricia. I echo a lot of your experiences, and I wish I could give some suggestions about how institutions could be improved. I think some of it has to come from, I think it's a very lonely pathway, and lonely because there might not be people who are like you to be able to reflect on these experiences with. I would hope as it becomes improved through EDI that we will have more of shared networks, and we will be able to have that kind of support and to develop our own self-confidence more. You know, there are so many surprising aspects that I find it very difficult to prepare for. I could have prepared for if I look back, and how institutions could actually support that. I think partly the support could come from knowing that there is protection, that there is some kind of, I mean, if you are excluded from publications because you are perceived to have been a retaliation for having written articles on your own, which is something that has happened to me, I've had to explain to those colleagues, well, I was not going off on my own to write articles. I was being commissioned to write articles because of the nature of the research, and that I'm asked to write certain articles because of how my ethnic identity is perceived, and that I own that, even if I don't want to always bring in the personal to my work. But that it has to be remembered that my name, my legacy, carries all the traumas and the tragedies associated with the stories that I'm writing with. So then they're not acts of privilege to be contacted by a major medical journal and asked to write an article. They become much more forms of obligation and responsibility than badges of honor. So, you know, and what you do when you can't, how do you prevent someone from excluding you because you publish elsewhere? These are very difficult things that speak to much more, to larger overarching structural elements about how somebody who is from a marginalized position is perceived to be able to occupy certain spaces. And unless we have more acceptance within our institutions and academia as a culture that people with marginalized identities and voices can actually speak loud and should be able to speak loud and shouldn't be told they're speaking too loudly or they're too vocal or they're too, I often get told, oh, you're too outgoing for a Muslim person. These comments that are always put on you, we need to be able to have our spaces expanded, I think, as a first step to preventing some of these aspects of researcher silencing that we've all been mentioning.
Just very briefly, I think, just to add to what's already been said, I think it's absolutely true that when you are busy doing activism, EDI work, and so on, somebody else is taking that time to publish and get grants, right? You absolutely have to recognize that. And so that's something to always keep in mind, how much time and labor you want to give and emotional labor you want to give to this work, because change is very, very slow. And what institutions could do, well, I don't know about compensation, but they could certainly recognize the work in a way that they haven't so far. So, for example, when it comes to precarity, look at what kind of work people have done and how they can be helped to continue to be that critical friend, to be that activist friend within the institution, to recognize that as qualification, as expertise, to recognize that in promotions document, it's still surprising how much things like tick boxes in terms of grant application, in terms of publication and so on, are still sort of the major markers of somebody who has achieved something in academia versus all the work you might have been doing to like hold this all together in terms of community and support and so on. So those are the things the institutions could start doing. Whether they're going to be doing it, I'm not holding my breath.
Well, we can always start with the to-do list and then work on holding them accountable. And with that, I'd like to thank all three of you for joining us in this discussion today, for sharing your wonderful wisdom, advice, very well thought out and considered answers, and in general, for sharing your time in doing advocacy and activism here with us at the Postgraduate Bioethics Conference. Thank you very much for your time, and I very much look forward to continuing these conversations beyond this.
Today's podcast about activism and advocacy as a postgraduate, we talked about a range of topics. We discussed motivations and goals behind activism and advocacy, different forms of activism and advocacy in academia, the benefits and risks to junior researchers engaging in such acts, then the burden on some academics to take action because of their identity, ways in which institutions can minimize this burden and make structural changes, and tips for sustainable activism and advocacy. The conversation made me think of the importance of understanding the academic landscape with its bureaucratic and power structures when engaging in activism. Also, it made me think of the importance of forming communities, appreciating all the hard work done by those who came before us and are in this journey together with us, and finally, of doing our part for those around us and those who are yet to come. Thanks for listening to the Power and Privilege in Academia podcast, brought to you by Black and Brown in Bioethics. Be sure to visit blackbrownbioethics.blogs.bristol.ac.uk to listen to more of our podcasts. Follow all